So for our next topic, we're going to talk about chronic lymphocytic leukemia. There's a very interesting ASH meeting this year with respect to that, a pretty interesting trial, the AMPLIFY study, looking at acalabrutinib and venetoclax. I'm real curious to see what the faculty thinks about that, as well as so many other things going on in CLL. We have Dr. Nicole LaManna from Columbia University, the Herbert Irving Comprehensive Cancer Center in New York. How you doing, Nicole? And Carey Rogers from The Ohio State University. Congratulations on your football. I don't know if you're a football fan.
Oh, yes. I'm a huge football fan, but I actually went to Northwestern for undergrad.
Okay,
so
well,
I didn't have a good year.
I don't know about Northwestern, but anyhow. And then Savan Shah from the Florida Cancer Specialists, who has some cases and questions to ask both of you. So we're going to start out talking about the issue of covalent Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibition and BCL-2 inhibitors in the management of a chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Of course, Nicole, the issue of first-line therapy of CLL has been really an interesting one over the last few years. Pretty different, sort of options for people to consider in terms of time-limited versus indefinite therapy. Before you get into kind of what's new, I'm just kind of curious if you can describe your thinking and strategy when you find somebody you want to treat first line, putting aside clinical trial, how do you sort through the two major options?
Yeah, and I did touch upon that a little bit, but there's no doubt, we're still, we don't know that one option is necessarily better than another. So in terms of start with sequencing, and so I still think you do need to talk to your patient and talk about the goals of therapy and, where they are in their life, whether they want to be on something that's chronic continuous, which is more easy to do, but it's continuous, and so there's downsides about that, versus something time-limited where they have to really put the effort up front. Although, Carey's going to talk a little bit about the AMPLIFY data, so that may change things. But, so you do have to have those kind of discussions. And so I still think that's very relevant for some of our older folks. They may only need one therapy. And so, our younger folks, I think we both feel, we have different strategies for our younger folks because they're likely going to see more than one therapy. So you have to take that into account.
So, Savan, I'm curious, how this plays out in your own practice. I hear people say even Nicole just sort of alluded to the fact that, younger people want time-limited therapy. I think maybe there are a lot of older people who want time-limited therapy. Curious how you see that playing out in your practice.
Yeah, I've been kind of approaching it pretty similar. A lot of these patients who are older, they're already on a lot of pills in a lot of cases, and so another pill may not be, a big deal to them, especially with how well tolerated, these new agents are, Zanu and Acal. So I've been using kind of a similar strategy as well. It's worked pretty well. Most people have done pretty well with them. And then younger patients, I tend to try to maybe approach with a time-limited approach. And they seem to, again, do pretty well, even though maybe a little bit more logistically intensive at first, but that seems to work really well. Patients who maybe have more comorbidities, but maybe still a little bit on the younger side, I'm talking late 60s, I have a patient, she has a history of CKD, TIA, chronic tobacco use. She was having some difficulty following up, so that's why I was thinking about, someone like her maybe using the BTK inhibitor with zanubrutinib, and she did really well with that, so.
So, Carey, anything you want to add to this? Actually, I want to ask too about the issue of the high-risk patient. And actually, Savan has a patient here, 69 years old, del17p TP53. Can you just kind of comment on her a little bit? And we can maybe bring up this issue of high-risk disease, Savan.
Yeah. So this was the patient. So she was referred to me for lymphocytosis, and she was symptomatic. She was having some fatigue. She was also found to have splenomegaly with some perisplenic varices. So we started with imaging as well as flow cytometry, and was consistent with CLL, which was P53 mutated and IGHV unmutated. So it was a high CLL IPI score and symptomatic with lymphocytosis. She had a stable home life, but difficult issues with the ability to follow up. I guess, what is your first line treatment in this scenario?
So, Carrie?
Yeah, I think, thanks. I think that's an excellent question. Now with the options we have, I like to think about things kind of in the order of based on the CLL risk features, which in this case is a TP53 mutation, then followed by like what's suitable for the patient given their comorbidities. You know, so if they have atrial fibrillation, that's like the worst thing that ever happened to them, and they've had four ablations and all this stuff, like probably the BTK inhibitor, even with the newer ones, might be problematic. So I think about like the CLL features and what might be best, and sometimes it's all good if you have intermediate or low-risk CLL. Then you think about like patient comorbidities, definitely think about patient preferences in there and see if that changes things. And more recently, I've been thinking about the patient's natural lifespan too. So if you have someone who's 88, their survival is probably not 40 years, so you don't really have to worry as much about what you're going to do in a couple decades. For high-risk CLL, there's really strong data for first-line continuous BTK inhibitors, where you really see kind of the same progression-free survival with continuous BTK inhibitor monotherapy as you do, you know, in non-deletion 17p or TP53 mutated CLL. So based on that, I definitely would recommend a continuous BTK inhibitor to someone who's looking to maximize their benefit from their first-line therapy. Just because I think in that particular high-risk group, it really does make a difference. Now, I have had people that were unsuitable for a BTK inhibitor or strongly preferred fixed-duration therapy, and I think that novel agent fixed-duration therapy is not wrong if that's what suits their comorbidities and preferences, but that discussion needs to be had. And for this patient, particularly given their ability to follow up might be worse, but their ability to take pills at home is probably good, I would suggest a BTK inhibitor and definitely one of the newer ones, because this person sounds like they have some cardiovascular risk factors, and also I've been using either acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib for all my patients. Just in 1 second, I want to point out that, you know, in the ELEVATE-TN, obinutuzumab does improve PFS when added to acal, but not in patients with deletion 17p. So this is definitely a BTK inhibitor monotherapy appropriate patient.
So interesting follow-up on this patient. What happened?
Yeah, so she started on zanubrutinib. I had her initially on 160 milligrams BID, had good response to treatment, but started having some treatment-related side effects. A couple things in particular, having some joint pain, but started having headaches. This is known, I think, in certain BTK inhibitors, but what is your approach? Do you ever refer to neurology in these patients?
So, Nicole, you know, when I saw headaches, I was interesting because you think about acalabrutinib, here's patients on zanubrutinib. First of all, any preference, zanubrutinib, acalabrutinib, Carrie said either one with P53, del-17P. Have you seen headaches with zanubrutinib? How bad are these headaches, incidentally?
It's pretty well controlled with Tylenol and some NSAIDs, which seem to work well for her, but she still complains about it at times.
How long has it been?
About 8 months now.
That's it, because I hear with a cala that it kind of goes away. But anyhow, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, so usually typically a cala is more the one that's most associated with headaches, although it doesn't mean that the other ones couldn't have it as well. And usually when that happens, it's usually in the beginning, you know, the first couple of weeks to months, and then it usually with supportive care management typically gets better. I mean, there's always a concern if they're on a BTK, if you're really concerned and want to image their head because you're worried about a bleed or something, you know, certainly I think that's not an unreasonable thing to do, given that it's a BTK inhibitor. Unless, you know, obviously in your lady, you know, sometimes, you know, dose reduction might help, may not. Sometimes switching the timing of the drug might help as well. So if they were taking the day, morning time, zanubrutinib, we could talk about, you can give as a once-a-day drug instead of a twice-a-day drug. Acala really is a twice-a-day drug. So there's a little bit more flexibility with zanubrutinib in terms of dose reductions and once-a-day versus twice-a-day. There's data, and they're going to be putting together more of that once-a-day dosing for reassurance for everybody. But they in the trials, they did both. So just keep that in mind. So you could do that, and you can switch timing. So there's a bunch of things you can try first to mitigate for some of the side effects. Obviously, if somebody has some side effect that's really affecting their quality of life, despite all these measures, then you can think about switching therapy.
So, Carrie, I'm curious whether you've seen insomnia with BTK. This lady had insomnia. How bad was it?
It got pretty bad. So she is, as the timing seems a little bit off, you know, but I still think that there's some relation to it. She really thinks that it was related to the medication, but she, to the point where she's on Seroquel, which she's been eating for her insomnia.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah. I've not really seen insomnia that I thought was directly related to a BTK inhibitor, but I fully believe that could happen. And what I usually say to patients is that this is not a kind of like known described effect of the drug, but that doesn't mean it's not happening to them. We do see a lot of anxiety in our CLL patients, which typically falls off actually as people start treatment and improve. Yeah. So you'll see insomnia in someone that looking at their labs, you know, has had CLL for a while, they get diagnosed, they get insomnia, and you can tell that is a manifestation of psychologic distress at the diagnosis. I've not really seen it with BTK inhibitors, but I would certainly try you know, giving it a different time of day, not doing BID, or for issues of tolerance, actually switching BTK inhibitors can be very effective. So even though I haven't seen that, I certainly believe it could happen, especially for an individual.
All right, Nicole, let's take a look at some data.
I think we just covered my entire talk.
It's a different way.
In a different way is right. Okay, there's my disclosures. So you can see I work with everybody. All right. So obviously we've been really blessed, and we're going to talk about all these agents. So you have, you know, and think about it. These are not new anymore. So ibrutinib's been around since 2013. So, you know, we can't say these are novel. But now we have Acala and Xana. We only have one BCL2 inhibitor, venetoclax, but there are others in development. We have sonrotoclax and lisaftoclax. So there's more that are coming down the pike. And now we have our first non-covalent BTK inhibitor with pirtobrutinib that got approved in December of 2023. And then our first CAR T cell, even though CAR T started in ALL and CLL back in the day, we finally have our first CAR T cell approval in March of last year with Lysocell. So lots of therapies, and Carrie will talk a lot about some of these newer ones. And again, just to kind of reiterate what we said in the beginning with the modern goals of, we don't know that one is better than another. So we definitely think about what the patient, we have the full discussion. It takes us longer to talk to our patients about these therapies in clinic. And so does somebody want something chronic and continuous? Remember, the BTK mechanism is one of suppression, right? So it inhibits proliferation. So there is good disease control and there's a prolonged PFS with these agents, but you're not going to get deep remissions in the bone marrow, right? So, you know, you can, complete responses can continue to increase over time the longer someone's on a BTK inhibitor. But really, if you look in the marrow, most patients still have, you know, measurable residual disease. So again, it's just a conversation. Fixed duration, we have Venobi, and obviously we're going to talk about oral-oral combinations. But, you know, you can get deep remissions with these therapies, get them off of therapy, hopefully give them a prolonged treatment-free remission interval. But you have to talk about whether that's in line with the goals of care, with what the patient wants, given that, you know, the Venobi is a little bit more challenging. I think orals will make that a little easier, but, you know, again, it's still a conversation to be had with your patients. So when we talk about this, I just want to sort of reiterate that, you know, we chemoimmunotherapy is something that I'm hoping most of you don't use anymore. We're really trying to move away. These are lots of pivotal trials with phase 3 studies showing that chemotherapy is inferior to the targeted agents. PFS benefit is reduced. Overall, you know, we obviously need much longer follow-up with the survival benefits in some of our clinical trials because people do so well with CLL, but some of them are now also showing that there's an overall survival benefit with targeted therapy. And this is some of that data that now that we have ibrutinib being the oldest, we have 8-year follow-up with Resonate showing ibrutinib compared to chlorambucil. So some of you might argue that that's an inferior comparison, but still the PFS benefit much better and in patients whether they're mutated or unmutated. Now in terms of real, you know, the chemoimmunotherapy that we used to use for older, frailer patients, ibrutinib plus or minus Rituxan with bendamustine and rituximab, again, the PFS benefiting ibrutinib-containing arm. So really trying to move away from bendamustine and rituximab, and certainly in our younger, fitter patients, when we used FCR, right, that was the gold standard for younger, fitter patients with CLL. Again, the PFS benefit for ibrutinib and even now a survival benefit. So moving away from chemoimmunotherapy. Now with the second generations, we have acalabrutinib. This is the ELEVATE-TN study that Carrie was referring to. And so you have acalabrutinib plus or minus obinutuzumab. I briefly glossed over for timing. There was no difference in benefit between the addition of rituximab to ibrutinib. But you could see here, there's a little bit of a PFS benefit with obinutuzumab when you add it to acalabrutinib in this study. And certainly, again, whether you're on acala mono or combination, better than chlorambucil and obinutuzumab. Now, when we talk about splitting hairs with the details of some of these studies, when you look about the acalabrutinib plus or minus the obinutuzumab arm, if you were unmutated, the obinutuzumab tended to add something, right? So this is something when we were talking about, as if you're thinking about, you know, strategizing those patients, if you have an unmutated patient, you might then say, you know, look at this benefit. I'm going to add obinutuzumab to the acalabrutinib. Now, again, that's a discussion because if somebody's choosing a chronic continuous therapy, they might not have wanted to have the IV in the first place. And so they're like, okay, thank you for telling me that benefit, but I really just wanted the pill in the first place. Otherwise, they would have chose a time-limited approach. So you're because they're going to continue the acala anyway. So you can share this data, but you got to talk about what the patient wants. So that's the in that sense. And then with the TP53 patients, you know, there wasn't a difference in the benefit by adding obinutuzumab to the acalabrutinib. So similar to what Kerry was saying, most of us would consider just giving a chronic continuous BTK inhibitor. Here's the addition, we're talking about Sequoia data with zanubrutinib. So now all the BTK inhibitors show this benefit. Here's this versus bendamustine and rituximab. Okay. Now, time limited. So let's talk about ven-obinutuzumab. You know, different strategy. So this is a 12-month therapy with venetoclax-obinutuzumab. And you can see versus obinutuzumab, chlorambucil, definitely a PFS benefit. Again, when you talk about details of therapy favoring, you see a little bit of a difference, again, with the PFS benefit in the mutated folks, right? So then if you think about when we talk about younger patients who have favorable disease who are mutated, this is like a great option. You get them off therapy. They have a time limited approach, they're going to do well. I still think, you know, if they're obviously you could see the curve comes down a little bit for the unmutated folks. So again, it's something you discuss with your patients. They still do really well. So it's not that I wouldn't offer somebody who's unmutated ven-OB, but there is a little bit of a difference in the PFS benefit. So keep that in mind. Now, we're obviously MRD has been something, we actually looked at MRD a long time ago with chemoimmunotherapy. We could never really convince the FDA to use it as an endpoint. But now with targeted therapies, I think we're starting to show that MRD could be extremely useful, and it may be helpful to try to, you know, whether or not we can use MRD to stratify or I should say, change how it modify some of these time-limited approaches. So there'll be definitely more data on this in the future. Now, there's different ways to test for MRD. Most of these trials did it with flow cytometry at 10 to the minus 4th, but certainly you can get at deeper levels, 10 to the minus 6. You could do clonoSEQ. There's lots of different ways, and hopefully, you know, there'll be more data approaching that. But the point being is that we know that if you achieve deep levels of remission, your PFS is going to be better, your overall survival is going to be better. So when we're looking at, you know, time-limited approaches, this is where there's some wiggle room about what we can do with some of these time-limited combinations and how maybe we can risk stratify and figure out who might be better for certain options of therapy and combinations or lengths and durations of therapy depending upon MRD status. Okay, high risk. We briefly talked about your patient with high risk disease. And I think just, you know, to sum and say is that, you know, in the era of chemoimmunotherapy, and that's on the left, the patients with 17p or TP53 deletion did terribly poor with chemoimmunotherapy. So really, we shouldn't be using any chemoimmunotherapy for patients with high risk disease. You could see how well the patients are doing with targeted therapies. Here's some the data with ibrutinib on the right. And then we have more data from some of the obviously bigger studies with ibrutinib. So really, patients with 17p, p53 are doing so much better with targeted therapies that this is really a gold standard. This is that data that I previously showed you with ELEVATE-TN. Certainly better with acala, but no difference in the a benefit with obinutuzumab to the TP53. And here's the Sequoia data with zanubrutinib. And this is probably one of the largest studies that we have prospectively with 17p deleted patients, over 100 patients. So we're going to be certainly very keen to follow this large cohort. But certainly, BTK inhibitors, 17p, really good therapy. Now, what about with the time limited? We alluded to that earlier, that the PFS does drop off for the patients who are unmutated and for the patients who have 17p. I don't prefer right now. I tend to try to talk to my patients about taking a chronic continuous if they have TP53, but I think it's certainly a discussion. If a patient says, I really want time-limited therapy, you know, am I going to say no? I mean, we have the discussion. I share with them the data, but, you know, there's no doubt that those patients are probably going to need more therapy, unless, again, like Kerry was saying, they're 88 and maybe not. Maybe they're going to die of something else. And so you do have to keep, I think that's an important thing to keep in mind as well. Which BTK, maybe we won't answer directly, but maybe indirectly. But I think it's safe to say is you really do need to, all the BTK inhibitors still have these special adverse events of special interest. You need to talk to your patients all about them. You know, it's a class effect, so it doesn't mean it can't happen. There might be differences in frequency, so keep that in mind. I'll not say I've never given warfarin to a patient on a BTK. I have. I think, again, you have to tell your patients about the increased risk of bruising and bleeding. I don't like to do anticoagulation and antiplatelet and a BTK. So that triple threat, I really don't like. So I really then usually try not to choose a BTK inhibitor. But it doesn't mean these things aren't manageable as long as the patients know the risks. And I think that's important. And you do have to counsel your patients if they're having some sort of surgical procedure that you want to intervene, you know, and say you got to hold your BTK, you know, depending upon the surgical procedure. And usually I don't like to hold the BTK if they're first starting therapy. So I tell them if you got any elective procedures, get them out of the way. Because if you're starting therapy first, you don't want them to flare in the beginning when they're first starting a BTK. So I usually say, let's try to move elective procedures for months later after your disease is under better control. If it's an emergency, you deal with the emergency. Okay. And we talked a little bit about Acala and headaches. Zanubrutinib, there's a little bit more neutropenia, though all the BTKs can have neutropenia. And then you can certainly switch agents. So I think that that is true. If it's not a life-threatening side effect, you can think about intolerance and switching agents if there's something that's really debilitating their quality of life. And Carrie's, they got good data for this. And there are other studies as well that you can do some, you know, internal class switching if the intolerance is not something that's not life-threatening. Because I'm running out of time, we know that there's selectivity, you know, depending upon, you know, the kinase, the domain that it hits. And so there are some differences in side effect. These are the head-to-head data. Definitely less cardiovascular events with the newer second generation, so keep that in mind, you know, with acalabrutinib and ibrutinib in this study, and then also with zanubrutinib and ibrutinib in this study, cardiovascular events were less. About hypertension and bleeding, very similar, but definitely less cardiovascular. So I think most of us would say if you're going to be on a BTK inhibitor, you should choose a, you know, you should choose a newer generation because of the cardiovascular events. But if I have somebody who's on ibrutinib, and many of us do because of the initial studies for 10 years and they're doing well, I leave them on therapy. If somebody's gone beyond 5 years and is doing well on ibrutinib, the likelihood is the side effects are not going to happen. They're doing great, and I would leave it. That's my sum to keep in time.
Awesome. So just a couple of follow-up questions, and I want to get into another case from Savin. So Carrie, I'm curious for an update. I know you, in terms of venetoclax and ramping up, because you have a lot of patients who are kind of come from far away, you guys were looking into an accelerated ramp up, you know, bringing people into the hospital. And then you start hearing more and more about debulking people first before they get to venetoclax. Now, with obinutuzumab, maybe in the future with, you know, BTK or acalabrutinib, we'll talk about Amplify. Do you still see patients who have high risk, and do you do this accelerated ramp up?
Yes, definitely. So I think, you know, I'm fortunate to work in a very well-resourced environment, so we have the ability to do this. But for patients particularly, and we started doing this for people whose CLL was progressing on ibrutinib, because that was the first BTK inhibitor, where you don't really have 5 weeks to wait to hit a target dose of this. So we would put people in the hospital and ramp up daily if they did not get tumor lysis. And if they did get biochemical tumor lysis or laboratory tumor lysis, we'd wait at that dose and then, you know, proceed once it was better. This requires a lot of resources. We had about half the patients develop some evidence of laboratory tumor lysis using the strategy. But it is, I think, a very good one. And I do get patients, especially from, you know, so I'm in Columbus, Ohio. I grew up in Chicago, so I don't think it's a big city, but my patients do. And they come from 2.5 hours away in rural communities. And so sometimes the right thing to do when you have someone that either like 5 weeks is too long for either them or for the disease control, we'll put them in the hospital and do a faster ramp up. I completely agree that with strategies like obinutuzumab, or I'm going to talk about this a little bit, using a BTK inhibitor first, we do see fewer patients that will have to, that will meet like the prescribing information's criteria to admit based on disease burden. So a lot of patients are now in the intermediate or low risk TLS category and can do their ramp up as an outpatient, which they mostly greatly prefer, except for people that just can't come for the 5 weeks. And again, these are patients where if they have options, might choose to do a continuous BTK inhibitor, but that's not something everybody's able to do, or some people need venetoclax for their next best therapy.
So, Nicole, any comments on the issue of ventricular arrhythmias? We had a case presented of somebody who was on ibrutinib who died in their sleep, and the doc was like, I wonder if... And there have been ventricular arrhythmias seen with BTK inhibitors. What's the update on that, and what do we know about the newer ones?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, mostly this was seen a lot more in the ibrutinib studies. There's been less report of that of the newer generations. In fact, you know, with the head-to-head studies, you know, the cardiovascular events and discontinuations due to those events were lower with either acalabrutinib and zanabrutinib. Of course, most of the problem is when most people have ventricular arrhythmia, you find out post-mortem. You know, these people die. So it is, you know, that's the problem. So it much reduced, again, with the newers and even with the non-covalence, you know, decreased frequency, but it's certainly a concern. So I think that what Carrie was talking about earlier, if you have a brittle cardiac patient and you're not sure, or there's a real concern about arrhythmias and things like that, you might choose not to do that if you're very, very concerned. But I think, you know, the newer generations are much safer, and the data is that the newer generations have less so.
So Carrie, Nicole was talking about MRD, and of course, one situation that's very interesting is at the end of time-limited therapy, for example, obinutuzumab venetoclax, where the trials, they looked at MRD. My question is, do you think people in practice should be looking at MRD? And if it's positive, would you continue therapy?
Not currently is the answer. We know that after venetoclax and obinutuzumab, you can check MRD. It's certainly helpful in counseling patients. Those with detectable disease would expect a shorter progression-free survival than those with no detectable measurable residual disease. However, I have no current data to suggest that therapy should be continued or discontinued in standard clinical practice based on this. I think when we look at data in different trials, we have these discussions like, should we do MRD-guided therapy? Should we not? Is it decreasing or increasing at these time points? But for patients that I treat as a standard of care and not in a clinical trial, I also think if we agreed to do fixed duration and you finished it, that's it. So checking the MRD can help, but I don't like help understand what to expect in the future, but I do not make treatment decisions based on this for patients I'm treating as a standard of care.
I mean, you can retreat also, you know, if they...
Right, exactly.
So all right, let's get on to another case from Savin. This looks like the history of CLL treatment. She gets a 69-year-old lady who gets diagnosed in 2005, gets observed until 2010, then gets FCR. Remember that, 2010? Nicole, when was the last time you used FCR?
It's been a while.
Yeah, and so then she gets rituximab, then she gets, in 2005, she's like, as things get approved, she gets treated. It's incredible. Yeah. Really just shows you the value of new clinical trials. 2015, she gets ibrutinib. I think that's about when it was approved or around that time. Yeah. 2020, she gets obinutuzumab venetoclax. 2024, last March, she gets zanubrutinib. And I guess it looks most recently, she's on venetoclax.
Yeah, so she obviously has been through multiple lines of treatment. She has a lot of comorbidities. She has CKD, she has CHF. She had a stage 1A lung cancer and had a lobectomy. So I had inherited this patient, she...
Now, what are you trying to say?
So she had a good response to venetoclax, and she tolerated it well in the past, and that's why it was selected. But would another agent, such as pirtobrutinib, be also reasonable here?
Can you talk a little bit about her comorbidities? And and I'm curious what you two think about the possibility of pirtobrutinib in the future. What comorbidities does she have?
Yeah,
she had lung cancer too.
She has CHF, she has CKD, she had the lung cancer. So, and a couple other things is that in 2019, I believe, she had herpes zoster ophthalmicus, and then ibrutinib was complicated by hepatitis and increasing LFTs as well. So she's had a lot of comorbid conditions. Yeah.
I mean, I actually think pirtobrutinib would be a good choice for this person. It's generally better tolerated than the covalent BTK inhibitors based on both selectivity and the non-covalent binding. Granted, she has some cardiovascular comorbidities. The renal failure doesn't really matter. But I think that's actually a great choice. The issue is the progression-free survival is not that long. So you've got about a year and a half where you expect that to work, and this person's 69, so.
Yeah.
I don't know. Incidentally, what would come after pirtobrutinib?
Right. That's exactly right. So that's what we were talking about, is that, you know, this is a patient that obviously has had all these options, but she's kind of ineligible for clinical trials, likely because of her comorbidities, right? Particularly the CKD may preclude her. So it's pretty challenging, because when these patients really try to, when they become refractory after a covalent and ven-based therapy, their PIVA, you know, their response durations are going to be short to subsequent therapies. And I agree with Carrie. I think Perto is a good choice only because of the CKD, and so even though they do have cardiovascular issues, but it only will last so long. So, and I don't know if this person really can get CAR-T, which Carrie's going to talk about, you know, so is that even an option for this patient with all her comorbidities? So it's pretty tricky. So we hope that she does long enough with Perto, we'll have another approval for her.
I'm kind of curious how many patients with CLL have, in your practice, including trials, have gotten CAR-T therapy, and do you think this patient would be eligible?
That's why I don't. I'm not sure she'll be eligible for CAR-T. That's my concern. I do use CAR-T, although I have to say that given, I think one of the issues that we have with CAR-T and CLL is you need a good response, and Carrie will show you this data. But second of all is, you know, because our therapies have been so good and we've, you know, had people live for years on these therapies, I haven't needed to use CAR-T a lot, I guess put it that way, in my practice.
I have trouble getting people to agree to it, actually, because they're so used to taking targeted agents, feeling well, and going about their life, which is what I want them to do, right? But now you've reached a point where you have someone, especially if they're still in their 60s and fit, that their lifespan will be shortened by CLL or they will die of it if you're on pirtobrutinib and you don't try something like that. I think it's a lot to go through. I have a lot of patients that, even if they're fit and perfect candidates, just won't agree to do it. And I think I've started talking about it earlier, but that is quite difficult. They're also not impressed with some of the complete remission rates, and I'll go through that data and you'll see why.
All right, let's go through the data.
Great. All right. Some of that's at the end, so I'm going to talk about some other things before you get to the CAR-T data we were just discussing. So we spent a lot of time talking about the strategy of covalent BTK inhibitor continuous monotherapy or venetoclax and obinutuzumab, but BTK inhibitor, BCL2 inhibitor combinations are really something that should be increasingly utilized now. These are highly effective. You get durable remissions. It's a fixed duration. And we're seeing that it does reduce the risk of molecular resistance, so both these classes of drugs can be reused on need for retreatment. I think the risk-benefit of adding, you know, a third drug in anti-CD20 is still a little unclear at this point. And most of the mature data is with venetoclax and ibrutinib, which is approved in Europe and helped by Health Canada, but not in the U.S. We now do have acalabrutinib, venetoclax, plus minus obinutuzumab in the NCCN guidelines. So this is something that I do think is now appropriate to offer our patients. Backing up a little bit and looking at some mature data, this is from Captivate, which is a large phase 2 study, and these are the fixed duration cohorts where it's 15 cycles total. There's long enough follow-up now to see how these risk groups we've been discussing do with this fixed duration therapy that includes a BTK inhibitor. So you can see, similar to what you see with venetoclax and obinutuzumab, people with IGHV unmutated CLL have a shorter progression-free survival, or a trend for it. And patients with high-risk features were in this analysis, they lumped deletion 17p, TP53 mutation, and or complex karyotype together, also as a shorter benefit. So I don't think this is an inappropriately short benefit, especially for the high-risk groups, as you would see with chemo immunotherapy. But this is something to keep in mind, that unlike with continuous BTK inhibitors, we do see these differences by risk group. So not to delve into this too much, because this is a phase 2 study, but this is a study we had at my institution where patients are still in follow-up after a 3-drug combination for 14 cycles, and it accrued in a kind of 3 different cohorts. And the only reason I mention that is we have follow-up now on the first 2 cohorts to actually reach a median progression-free survival, and this is the first time we've had a median PFS with this 3-drug combination, and it's 7.4 years in the first treatment-naive patient cohort. So that kind of compares as a bit longer than the 6.5 you get out of venobin and CLL14, or the nearly 9 you get out of continuous ibrutinib. Just to kind of show where that falls, there is a phase 3 study that's been reported. This is an alliance study that randomized elderly patients or older to the 3-drug combination compared to ibrutinib with obinutuzumab, where ibrutinib was continued. This study was actually powered for superiority, trying to demonstrate that the blue arm there, which is the 3 drugs, is superior, which of course it was not actually. So the hazard ratio was not different between the two arms and certainly wasn't going to be superior, like that blue arm's never going to be better for PFS. So this was actually reported early due to futility. However, similarly designed study in younger patients is ongoing. That was powered for non-inferiority. So we will see if the three drugs is non-inferior to two in younger patients. The major reason I included this is you can really see clearly in the study the impact of COVID-19 deaths, where if they're censored, the PFS curves are higher and they're overlapping, suggesting that more drugs is more COVID risk, and I'll get to that in a minute. So this is the study we've sort of been alluding to. This is the AMPLIFY study, which is now reported in the NAJM for your reading enjoyment. I'm going to summarize it here for you. So this is a first treatment study in fit patients. So this is not elderly unfit, it's fit patients, and actually excluded deletion 17P or TP53 mutated because of the chemoimmunotherapy, and it compared investigator's choice of BR or FCR to AV or AV with O. And you can kind of see the treatment diagram for the AV and AVO. This is the primary endpoint of progression-free survival. The primary endpoint was actually AV compared to chemoimmunotherapy, and you can see it was significantly better. And then they tested AVO compared to chemoimmunotherapy, which is also better in terms of progression-free survival. So this met its endpoints for both investigational arms. This was not designed to compare AV to AVO, so you can go ahead and interpret the curves as you will, but that's not something the study was powered to do. This is broken down by IGHV status, and I put some little call-outs on there because it's really hard to look at with all these curves and shading. But the takeaway here is that for AVO, the IGHV mutated and unmutated CLL patient PFS is overlapping, really showing that when you add obinutuzumab in, you kind of make the outcomes equal between IGHV mutated and unmutated CLL patients. And AV for mutated patients is right in there, suggesting that the obin doesn't really add much for IGHV mutated patients. And remember, this did not include deletion 17P. So it's showing that the majority of the benefit to the O is in IGHV unmutated CLL. Lastly, here is overall survival, and I'm showing you with or without COVID-19 deaths censored, which was a specified analysis of the study. And you can see that AV actually had the fewest COVID deaths at 10, with both antibody-containing arms having either 25 or 21. So this is highlighting that this is a very real risk to adding an antibody here, and while certainly I wouldn't expect this many COVID deaths at the current time frame, I think this does really mean that obinutuzumab adds some risk here that we have to consider carefully when we're looking at the benefit. MRD was looked at in this study, and actually AV had the lowest rates of undetectable MRD at the end of treatment. AVO had the highest. And so I think something to think about here is that despite lower rates of undetectable MRD, the PFS was better with AV. So I'm not sure that MRD means the same thing after chemotherapy as it does after those targeted agents. Acalabrutinib is not the only BTK inhibitor in addition to ibrutinib that's been combined with venetoclax. So this is actually arm D of Sequoia, and Nicole was talking about arms A and B and C before. So these were initially patients with deletion 17P CLL that got ZV. It had a very complicated MRD-driven discontinuation scheme, but the overall response rates are high. This highlights that the strategy of BTK inhibitor venetoclax does, of course, work in high-risk patients. They're now occurring some non-deletion 17P patients, so I look forward to that. We also now have sonrotoclax. So this is a novel BCL-2 inhibitor that has BCL-XL activity. It was combined with zanubrutinib at two different doses in a phase 1 study with very high response and MRD rates, and is now in a fully accrued phase 3 study called Celestial, comparing it to venobin. So I'm really looking forward to this and hope that it really gives us another BTK inhibitor, BCL-2 inhibitor combination. To cover novel agents just for a few minutes, we talked about pirtobrutinib. I think everyone's familiar with the phase 1-2 study, but this is actually the phase 3 study that compared it to idela, cibrituximab, or BR, which I think none of us would prefer to use in this setting, but is probably the standard comparator here. And these were for patients that had had a covalent BTK inhibitor. And if you look, some of them had more than one covalent BTK inhibitor, half had a BCL-2 inhibitor, and most had progressed on a BTK inhibitor. the median progression-free survival here for pirtobrutinib was better than the standard arm, but was still only 14 months. So this is really showing you that this is not the benefit we need for a lot of our CLL patients. There are several exciting phase 3 studies ongoing with pirtobrutinib, including a randomized comparison to ibrutinib, a similar design to what Sequoia was with pirtobrutinib versus BR in a frontline setting, and then this, I think, really interesting study that's VenR compared to pirtobrutinib VenR in previously treated CLL. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how pirtobrutinib does in all these studies in the future. So this is updated data on liso-cel, which is the CAR-T product that was approved for CLL. There are kind of two major things that we recently learned about it. One is that complete remission, or complete remission with incomplete marrow recovery, is really what the patients need to be able to get a very durable remission here. Granted, partial remission can get you a little time, and then non-responders do poorly with this. So getting this CR response, unlike what we talk about with our targeted agents, actually matters. And this was only about 1 out of 5 or 20% of the patients. So while it's durable, that's not awesome. I think the toxicities of this were fairly manageable. You know, there's a high rate of CRS, but mostly not high grade. My patients worry a lot about this, but I do think we're getting better at managing CAR-T toxicities, especially when it's used across a variety of diseases. This was the data that actually impressed me the most about liso-cel, and this was an update from a cohort of Transcend that actually treated patients with ibrutinib throughout the process. So they received ibrutinib pre-collection, through lymphodepletion, and after cell infusion. Now, if you're looking at that PFS and thinking, boy, this looks the same as the PFS you're showing me for, you know, the global liso-cel, where you still get non-responders doing terribly and the CR kind of doing the best, the important thing to know is that 45% of patients who were treated in this way were on that CR line. So you've got, you know, twice as many patients now expecting to get a durable remission. I don't know if this is going to be the case with other BTK inhibitors. We don't know if it's that it improves T-cell fitness, improves disease control, improves cytokine environment, but I think this is very compelling. And then lastly, I just want to mention BTK degraders, because when I was thinking about that case where we're suggesting pirtobrutinib could be next, if she were fit for a trial, this could be after that. So these are drugs that are still investigational, but they remove the BTK protein through cells protein degradation machinery. We've seen phase 1 data with compounds from various companies, including Nurex, and I'm showing you a swimmer's plot for a BeiGene compound there. So I think this is really exciting for the future.
So yeah, last night we were talking about estrogen receptor degraders, so interesting that you have a BTK. So Nicole, I'm curious about your thoughts in terms of the AMPLIFY study of acalabrutinib followed by venetoclax time-limited therapy. I've heard I asked people, well, who would you treat this with if you could? And people say, oh, people would prefer oral time-limited therapy. I'm like, well, who wouldn't prefer oral time-limited therapy?
Agreed.
But, you know, sort of beyond that, I mean, yeah. Is this something you think you're going to be using for everybody?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that, you know, we didn't mean to say that all older people don't want a time-limited therapy. I think that I still would offer that if an older person wants to commit to do that. It's not that we just go, oh, you just get a chronic BTK because you're older. You know, I think that there are people who can get time limited. This certainly, does it make it more appealing? Yes. I mean, if they're not getting an intravenous component. But there's no doubt, I think that the responses look really well. The goal about, when we think about, again, different approach, the goal about time limited too is when we think about the chronic BTKs, even though many can last for years and do very well, we showed you those PFS curves, there's no doubt that a lot of people develop resistance to the BTK inhibitors because it's chronic and continuous. And so when you do a time-limited approach, the likelihood of develop resistance mutations is very infrequent. And then you have the ability to then re-challenge later on with those therapies if they have a nice durable response duration, which means you could use those agents again. And think about that. When we're, again, it is a journey. So we're thinking about, I mean, everybody's always worried about their first therapy, but we're thinking about their next therapy, their next therapy, their next therapy. So then think about that. You have the option of reusing drugs, plus you have other drugs. And so that time duration, you know, you start, the goal is to have these people live a normal lifespan with their CLL because none of this is curative. Again, if they're older, maybe it doesn't matter. But if they're younger, it does matter. We're thinking ahead. And remember, people will acquire other cytogenetic mutations in a 17p or p53. And so you have to think about those things too. So that's why I do think you're going to see more easily more uptake in the oral combinations with the approval. I also think that it'll be more appealing to patients. So even older patients might want to do it. So I think you'll have more of that. So yes, I think that you're going to see the adopt and that whole, debulking with the ven will be much easier because you're going to front load the BTK and then people can do it as an outpatient. So also the resource issue becomes easier. So yes.
And in a second, Savannah, I'm going to ask if you, I'm curious how you process when a new trial comes out just the last couple of months, if you have any questions about this or anything else, but just first to get back to Carrie, not only are you avoiding IV, but you're avoiding obinutuzumab, which is not necessarily the easiest experience to have. Again, I'm curious how you think you're going to integrate this strategy. Would you think about using Zanu instead of Acala, if the Acala and Ven is approved? When I first saw the abstract for Amplify, the thing that really struck me was how many deaths from COVID were in that trial.
Yeah.
It was done right in the middle of COVID.
Yeah.
And, we had this sort of theoretical thing about CD20 and all, and then here it is right in your face. And you were kind of commenting now, COVID is still here. Anyhow, what are you thinking about Amplify, Carrie?
Yeah, so I think for my patients, both younger and older, I have a lot of them that even if I have someone that's like has IGHV mutated CLL where I've recommended venetoclax and obinutuzumab, they won't take 8 weeks to come do it. And while I work with very experienced infusion nurses and the infusion reactions aren't a big deal for me, they are horrifying for the patients. And so I have gotten a few people now where I'd recommended fixed duration therapy to agree to do Acala and Ven because it's only a 5-week ramp up and there's no infusion. So that was kind of more acceptable to them. So I'm hopeful that I'll get some people who are choosing continuous BTK inhibitors for convenience that might decide that this is convenient enough to do. I also think there's some people that are getting Ven-Obin that actually might find it more convenient and acceptable to do AV. And I think for AVO, it's a little bit harder because, the benefit is there for people with IGHV unmutated CLL, but I'm not sure in all cases that benefit's enough to add a third drug. And while I wouldn't expect to see that many COVID deaths, as I was saying, this is a real risk that you can see just played out in that circumstance.
I saw Eric Rupart, his medical oncologist in Reading, Pennsylvania, here in the audience. He came down with a few of his colleagues from Pennsylvania, I guess for a little warm air. He calls it the shakes and bakes for the obinutuzumab. I like that. So, Savin, any questions?
No, but I think the most interesting thing was the MRD data that you presented and how MRD didn't necessarily seem to reflect even with PFS. So, we do MRD and, in the community, we're sometimes like, well, do we do MRD? Do we don't do it? I'm sure you guys do it a lot more than we do because you have a lot more prognostic information and the way you utilize it. But it's a good question for us all the time and not even in CLL is the MRD data. So, how would you use it based on this trial? So, yeah. Or would you use it at all?
I was just going to say that within each arm, if you look at in chemoimmunotherapy, MRD positive has a shorter PFS than MRD yep. negative. Within AV, MRD positive is a shorter PFS than MRD negative. So within the arms, it does differentiate, but you've still got this lower rates of MRD negativity with a better PFS between AV and chemoimmunotherapy. So if I treat someone as standard of care, I actually don't do this. I think it causes more confusion than help for the patients.
Yeah.
So a couple questions from the audience, from Sean, Nicole, who says, is the BR regimen dead for CLL?
Yeah. We'll keep that short.
Okay.
To be fair, if there's, an area that the patients can't get a targeted therapy, whether it's due to insurance or lack of resources in different countries, yeah, for sure. Chemo immunotherapy obviously worked, right? It's not like we're saying it doesn't. But in the modern era and with the curves we've just showed you from lots of the studies, we would really suppress chemo immunotherapy.
Are we seeing, I've heard people say there still is BR being used. You do these real world, is that happening? And what's the reason? It's hard to believe it's the doc. You think it is maybe reimbursement issues or why are people?
It shouldn't. I would think at this day and age, there really shouldn't be an issues. Even with copay, a lot of these, there are grants that can be run for patients. So most of the time, if somebody's got a high copay, those are usually dramatically reduced. And so it's really, I can name a handful where that might be an issue, but really for the majority of patients, that shouldn't be an issue at all. And so no.
So Carrie Gautam wants to know, is the recommendation to wait for symptoms to start treatment on the way out, particularly in younger patients, I'll add high risk?
Yes, I the recommendation is still to wait until there is something to improve. Sometimes it's actually the blood counts are, you know, really needing treatment based on developing anemia and thrombocytopenia, and the patient actually is asymptomatic from this, especially in younger fit people. But there's no reason to treat early. And in fact, the CLL12 study, which was an ibrutinib early intervention study by the German CLL study group, was recently reported, follow-up from it was reported, showing that there's no overall survival benefit to treating earlier. So now we know that with ibrutinib, the EVOLVE study, which uses venobin, is still accruing. But there's absolutely no reason, high risk, low risk, fit, unfit, older, younger, there's no reason to start treatment before it's needed. There's, of course, a window where it's like treatment's reasonable and now you're miserable. It's usually months to a year. So I'm not saying there's not wiggle room on when to do it. But if there's no treatment indications, I don't treat.
All righty. Thanks so much. It was great.